Ah, yes, that music once again. It is perhaps music to the ears of a lot of people, as Wax Ecstatic is finally out of the extended rain delay. Can I have an hallelujah? Hello there, your host Matt Salmon here. By the way, Happy New Year. It's only been 9 months since our last show, but hopefully we're going to make it worth your while. As we're going to change things up a little bit, and no, I have no idea how long this is going to continue on. We've exited our extended rain delay, and I think this may be more of a rehab start. I don't know, rehab stint. Probably should have gone into rehab years ago, but that's another story. But anyways, we're going to welcome back the fans who have chimed in with some great questions, which I'll get to in just a few minutes. Also, going to rip into a 1981 Topps grocery pack that's been sitting around in my house for several years now. I don't even remember when I bought it. But that's one of those vintage packs that is actually not that hard to find. It doesn't sell for as much. So yeah, I could just put it on eBay and, you know, see where it goes. But I might be able to cover the cost of shipping with it. So instead of going through all of that hassle, I've decided to just rip it open and we'll take a look inside. And we will look at it because, as you saw in the social media tweet at Wax and Gumstains, our Twitter feed, I've actually posted video. So what we're going to do is the video of me tearing into this pack of 81 Topps, or the rack pack, if you will, the grocery pack. We're going to sync it up here, so you're going to be able to hear it here on the podcast, but also if you have the chance to jump on YouTube, you can watch it, and you can watch it before we get there. You can press pause right now, but don't do it, because we'll try to entertain you. But you could press pause now and, you know, watch the pack break and then come back to the podcast, but that would be kind of odd. So hang around. We'll get to that in a few minutes. And what I'm going to do is we're going to take the cards from this grocery pack, and I'm just going to go through them and just, you know, just random thoughts of the various players that come through here. I'll mention them. It's not all that different from what is out there right now. The trading card database does this. One of their hosts has gone out to ballparks, and this is great. You know, he'll track down, like I saw a recent episode, CeCe Sabathia opening up some packs from the mid-90s and talking about some of the players that he admired or perhaps even played with. And it's not all that different, except I don't have CeCe Sabathia here in my studio. Nor anyone else, for that fact. And also, I've seen Deadspin do it recently, where they will just open up a pack of cards, and they've been doing some 81 Fleer recently, and they'll just go through it and just talk about some of the players that are there. So, you know, I kind of like that. We'll kind of go with that. If you're new to the podcast, welcome aboard. As I mentioned, my name is Matt Salmon. My day job is director of broadcasting for the Tampa Bay Lightning, and that is one of the many reasons why we had the extended rain delay. Basically, when I started this podcast back in the summer of 2016, started it on a whim, joked that it would last only about 5 weeks, and lo and behold, I found an audience. And thank you, audience, for hanging with us here. But I found an audience, and we, you know, went through this box of cards that I had, and I said, okay, you know, it was from the junk wax era from the 80s and early 90s when I collected as a kid. And I would go through this big box, the big old monster box, as I called it, and I pull out a card from each set from each year. And we would talk about the set and talk about the player and have a lot of fun with it. And basically, the show went from this box to a binder covering cards from the mid-1950s up through 1980. And then as the show progressed, you know, it's gathering some steam and things are going well, and we would auction off some packs and do some breaks on YouTube. And then, you know, once we got to 1980 Tops, we'd basically covered the entire spectrum from 1957 through 1993. I had one card from 1954, but, you know, basically provided this history book of about 40 years of baseball cards. And we carried it on, but, you know, it lost some steam. Suddenly, we had fewer listeners. It was becoming a chore to do the show, not because I didn't want to, but just because of, you know, work. You know, things were getting kind of busy at the start of this past hockey season. And also life. You know, I got two kids. I got a wife. You know, I got to take care of them. And, you know, my son is 8 years old now, plays Little League ball. So I like coaching Little League. So I was able to do that. And I just didn't have a lot of time to really dedicate a quality podcast. And that is a big thing for me is quality. Because we've all seen the god-awful videos on YouTube. We've all seen or have all listened to the really terrible podcast attempts, not just necessarily in baseball cards, but in everything. And I really don't want to do that. So basically what I want to do is try to keep this show high quality, you know, to the best of our ability. And we're going to do, you know, just over the summer, you know, I can't promise anything. We're just going to try to keep this going for at least a few weeks, just kind of see where it goes from there. As I mentioned, we're going to break an 81 Tops grocery pack today. The reason why the podcast is out a little later than usual is because I have the day off from work and I was actually visiting the local card shops, which is a lot harder to do these days than back when I was a kid. If you type in baseball card shops Tampa Bay in Google, you get about five hits. And when I say five hits, I mean five hits in like a 50-mile radius of Tampa. When I was growing up in the late 80s and early 90s, there were five card shops in my neighborhood. Never mind just the area. So, you know, burned a couple gallons of gas, hitting up a couple stores I haven't been to, but, you know, made some junk wax purchases. Also just got a package from an eBay seller who just had a whole plethora of mid-80s cello packs that I purchased. His name is Steve Bushy, by the way. He is based in Illinois. And he had a really good deal, just, again, you know, some mid-80s cello packs, decent price even with shipping. So we're going to continue on that vein of just grabbing some old cello packs, some wax packs, and just kind of ripping through them. And like I said, going through them, you'll see the break on YouTube. We'll talk about the players that are in that pack, talk about some of the individual cards, and we'll have some fun with it. Now, before we get to the listener questions, I do want to acknowledge several people who we had featured on the program in its first run, who unfortunately have passed away. And after you spend a lot of time, you know, researching these players and looking up these cards and everything, you know, when you hear about these players passing on, it's sad news. So we want to acknowledge the late Oscar Gamble, who was our featured card in episode 86 on 73 Tops. Oscar Gamble passed away just a few months ago. Also one of my favorites, Le Grand Orange, yes, Rusty Staub from episode 77 on 64 Tops. He passed away not too long ago, and he was dealing with a whole lot of health issues for much of his latter years. In fact, we mentioned in the show that he had survived a heart attack while on a flight from Ireland to New York just a couple of years ago, but was able to get back into better health rather quickly so that he could deliver the first pitch at a World Series game for the Mets. So he was able to dodge a bullet there, but unfortunately, Rusty passing away not that long ago. Also, going all the way back to episode 4, the 81 Donruss episode, where we pulled the dreaded manager card, or in this case, it was a coach card, but the late, great Red Shaindienst, who passed away just a few weeks ago. Mr. Cardinal Red Shaindienst, he was a member of Major League Baseball for over 70 years, and for all but I think maybe five or six of those years, he was with the Cardinals. And like I said, he passed away just a few weeks ago. And when you read about some of these players and you know, a manager, you know, player turned coach turned manager like Red Schandienstein, it's always sad news there. But we wanted to give the old proverbial tip of the cap to all three of those gentlemen who were subjects of previous episodes, who we just wanted to acknowledge as they passed away since our last episode, which was all the way back in November when I pulled from the 1980 top set Dave Steeb's rookie card. And as you listen back to that old episode, you'll find out that that was not a random pull, so to speak. That was done on purpose. And simply because Dave Steeb was one of my players. And that actually ties nicely into one of the questions we received from our listeners. And I'm glad that I asked this question on our social media, our Twitter feed, Wax and Gum Stains, because I had to put some thought into some of these questions that were asked, and I'm referring mostly to Doug McCready, longtime listener, who jumps in. One question I would pose would be, if you could only have five of your cards and you had to get rid of the rest, what five would you keep? And then he throws in this caveat, autograph cards not included. Well, a very interesting question, and I really had to rack my brain over it because even though I don't have quite the plethora of cards that I had when I was a child, and I mean maybe 10% of what I had, I built up a collection of nearly, actually not nearly, more than 50,000 cards by the time I was a teenager. You know, the ones that I kept from the junk wax days, you know, really have some special meaning to me. So one is obviously that 1980 Topps Dave Steeb card. Steeb was my favorite player. The Blue Jays were my favorite team. And even though I collected all of his cards throughout his career, if I had to, you know, pluck one from that set to hang on to, it kind of remind me of not only that collection I had, but also the connection I had to him, then that would have to be the one. And if you want to hear more of the story about that connection I have to Dave Steeb, episode 102, the one right before this, you can listen to it. I've got a great story about actually meeting him in person back in 1991. So that's card number one. So then I thought, all right, what other cards are out there? Well, another one is the 1982 Donruss Cal Ripken Jr. rookie that I pulled back in, I think it was 1990 or 91. And I talk a little bit about that pulling of the card back in one of our episodes, in fact, featuring 82 Donruss, episode number 6. Larry Heisel was the featured player, the featured card in that show. And I will give you the short version of the story here. Basically, I was probably 12 or 13 years old, went to a local card store, saved up a few bucks. They had some vintage boxes. So again, this is 1990, 91, somewhere around there. I plunked down, I think it was $5 for a pack of 82 Donruss. And I pulled a Cal Ripken Jr. rookie card. This was like the biggest pull I had ever made in my young collecting career back then. And even though the value of the card has gone, you see, back then it was like $50. It shot up to like $100. Now it's like $25 or $30. Even though it's gone through the roller coaster, I would definitely have to keep that card because there's that special memory, that emotion I got of, you know, rummaging through these otherwise, you know, who cares cards. And here's a Cal Ripken Jr. rookie when he's in the prime of his career. I mean, that was, again, the first big find I ever had pulling from wax when I was a kid. So that's one. Now, another one is an 87 Fleer Barry Bonds rookie card. And I have a similar story to the 82 Donruss Ripken. In this was probably 1997, 98, something like that. I went to a local card shop, and this was when the hobby was just imploding. There was just too much. It was just everywhere. And the first place where it imploded were, of course, packs and singles from the late 80s and early 90s. So I'm in this card shop just kind of wandering around, and the store has, you know, the 50-cent pack basket or something like that. And I go rummaging through there, and amongst all the 88 Donruss and 91 Score packs, I do find an 87 Fleer pack, or two, actually, now that I think of it. And, you know, again, I got these for like a dollar total, so sure, why not? And I get home, I open it up, and there's a Barry Bonds rookie card, which, other than a very slight line of red ink on the back of the card, a little printing flaw, is pretty much in mint condition. So I actually took that home and just locked it down into one of those thick card holders. I'm sure the printing error would probably take a little bit off there, but, you know, again, less the actual value of the card and more the sentimental value. You know, this was, again, a great pull, you know, a $10 card from a 50-cent pack that was basically discarded in the bin of deplorable wax packs from the late 80s and early 90s. All right, so that's card number three. Card number four is the Pee Wee Reese 57 Topps card that we featured in episode 70. It is beaten up. Just look at the picture on the podcast. It's been through hell and back. But I still like it for reasons I explained back in that episode. Even though I bought this particular card at a garage sale for, I think, 50 cents, I like it for a couple of reasons. One, it's a 1957 Topps card. You can't go wrong with 57 Topps. It was groundbreaking for a number of reasons, in which we covered in the program. But also, it's the only tangible connection I have from the period of the Brooklyn Dodgers. And every baseball fan has some kind of connection to the Brooklyn Dodgers, even if they don't want to acknowledge it. But the Brooklyn Dodgers, even though Ebbets Field was this tiny bandbox that was, you know, not very well maintained, even though the Dodgers, with the exception of those teams in the mid-50s, were the bums, you know, that laughable team that got curb-stomped by the Yankees and Giants in one form or fashion throughout the years, you know, even though they moved to Los Angeles and found a lot of success there, there's that yearning for the Brooklyn Dodgers. And because my dad was born and raised in Brooklyn and actually attended Dodgers games, and even after the Dodgers left for Los Angeles, he and his father would occasionally take a train to Philadelphia to see the Dodgers when they played the Phillies back in the day. You know, because of all of those stories, I had this connection to this thoroughly beaten to a pulp 57 Topps Pee Wee Reese card, card number 30 of the 1957 Topps set. So that's card number four. And then card number five, I'm sitting there going, all right, well, what am I going to go with that? I thought for comic relief, maybe my 76 Topps Roland office card, just because, you know, Roland looks like you farted on his couch and he knows it. But then I thought, no. You can get a 76 Topps Roland office card anywhere. So I thought and I thought and I thought and I went, well, you know, I collected more than baseball cards when I was a kid. I collected hockey cards as well. And I thought of one that stood out, one that, again, 20 or so years ago, I purchased at a flea market in Kissimmee, Florida, a 1979-80 Topps Gordie Howe card. It's the only Gordie Howe card I have from when he was actually a player. It's not a reprint card. And it features Gordie Howe with the Hartford Whalers, and even better, and for you hockey nerds or uni-watch geeks such as yours truly, the Whalers were the New England Whalers before they became the Hartford Whalers when they were absorbed into the NHL merger with the WHA. So it's Gordie Howe. It's that great 79-80 Topps / OPC design. It's the Hartford Whalers. But Mr. Hockey is wearing the New England Whalers sweater, which is different from the Hartford Whalers sweater, if you didn't know. And there's just this culmination of really cool things coming together with that one card. So while I've got a lot of great hockey cards from the 70s and 80s, I would want to keep that Gordie Howe card, simply because he's Gordie Howe and, you know, he's donning the Whalers sweater. So again, great question there, Doug, and thank you very much for posing it. And thank you, too, for hanging in there during our extended rain delay. From Wax Pack 916, another longtime listener, great to have you check in from sunny and warm Buffalo, New York this summer. It's great to hear from you. Question for the show, thoughts on new products? Have you picked up any thoughts on Topps Living Set? Well, let me start with the Topps Living Set. I haven't purchased Topps Living Set, but I think it's a very ingenious idea from Topps for a number of reasons. One, from the marketing and promotional side, I think it's great to have a living set, a set that doesn't end. And basically, they add three new cards to it every week. It's designed in the 1953 Topps design, which is a collector favorite. If you like really nice artwork, you can basically find this 53 Topps inspired artwork of your current favorite players, which I think is a neat mix. And also the devious side of the marketing, they only have them available at the Topps store for 7 days. So it's, you know, you got to get it now or else, which is just brilliant business decision right there. It really is. I'm not one that has to have cards like that, but I think for the diehard collector that wants something unique, they'll pay that premium. And certainly Topps believes that there's an audience out there for it. I think just the general idea of it, of having a never-ending set, is also very smart. And, it's a good thing to remember, too, that, you know, sets that are finite in the sense that it starts with card number one and ends with card number whatever. There's a limitation to it. And what I mean by that is, if I say 87 Topps, you know what it looks like. You know the key cards, you know the ones you want to keep, the ones you want to get rid of, the ones that you laugh at all over again. But you can't get an 87 Topps, I'm trying to think of a good example here, an 87 Topps Tom Glavine card. Because, you know, the Tom Glavine cards didn't come out until 1988 in the Topps set. Same thing, you know, Greg Maddux, you had to get the Topps traded set to get a Greg Maddux or a Fred McGriff from 1987. So there was a finite part to the original top set. So to have the living set, the set that never ends, they just keep adding three cards to it over and over, allegedly until infinity. I think that's kind of neat. You know, it's the set that doesn't go away, where other sets you can define and kind of box into, okay, this was a good set, this was not a good set, this was not a well-designed set, this was a perfectly designed set. You take a design that's already popular, that's already well-liked by collectors everywhere and baseball fans, has already been used in this purpose. You know, that was part of the Topps Archive set that was released in, I think, 91 or 92, you know, sometime in the early 90s. They basically, you know, re-released the 53 Topps set, but in a glossy format with some additional, you know, quote-unquote missing cards. That was kind of a neat thing there. So there's a lot of wins there for Topps. I'm not going to be somebody who buys it, but I think it's pretty interesting. Now, as for the new product, yes, I have bought some. But as I've said before, it's very easy to go sliding down that slippery slope of too much product out there. And that's kind of the irony of the baseball card hobby right now, is that Topps is the company that has the exclusive license with Major League Baseball and the Players Association to produce cards, not only with the players' likenesses, but also team logos and script and all that stuff. So Topps is the only licensed company, but as you know, you have Topps, you have Topps Heritage, you have Topps Opening Day, you have Topps Archives, you have the Topps Living Set, you have Topps Stadium Club, you've got Bowman, you've got all of these different subsets of brands underneath the Topps umbrella. And the irony is that, okay, you've got one licensed producer of these cards, but about 30 different brand names underneath it. And that was part of the problem with the hobby 25, 30 years ago. You just had too many cards. There was just too much that was out there. Now, you don't have that problem today in the sense that, you know, there's a, an oversaturation, but it's very easy to sample this and sample that, and then all of a sudden you're buying a little bit of it all, and at the end of the season you've got 5,000 cards, you have no idea how they got there, and you don't know what to do with the 4,900 cards that are considered common and you don't really want them. So I have limited my purchases to two brands, the main top set and Topps Heritage. And I love Heritage because I am a collector of vintage. But, you know, the big problem with Heritage this year, while I was never a big fan of the 1969 design, the original 1969 Topps cards, even though there are some great cards from it, I did like the Heritage. And when they first came out, I bought, you know, a few boxes, you know, not hobby boxes, but, you know, the retail boxes where you get 7 or 8 packs in them at Target and Walmart. Bought a few of the, you know, blaster packs, you know, got probably about 300 of the cards and, you know, a pretty nice little collection of cards out of all that. But then came Ohtani and the fascination with the Ohtani inserts. And again, talk about good business, good marketing from the Topps people. You don't just have your regular old Ohtani card in Series 1 of Topps Heritage. You've got the red ink autograph. You've got the blue ink autograph. You've got this variation, that variation. And that has driven the price of these cards through the roof. And now, good luck getting them at your local Target or Walmart, because collectors have snapped them up. They're now selling them for twice the price on eBay. And then, of course, hobby boxes. You know, I was checking them out at those local card shops today. You know, the hobby boxes are, you know, in the neighborhood of $200. And, hey, you know, I like the product, like the hobby, but I also like my wife and kids who I need to take care of. So not quite splurging on the $200 box of baseball cards just yet. Much like the 21-year-old bottle of scotch, I'm doing well in life, but not quite well enough to get that top shelf. So I got to go with a 14-year, which is still not too shabby. But yeah, to answer your question, I have sampled the new Topps. I've sampled the Topps Heritage. Those are pretty much my go-to every year. And because the Heritage has been drying up, I've gone back to the original Topps, which I'm not thrilled about, but they've got some good inserts. Overall, good design. And hey, if I've got the itch to buy brand new baseball cards, it's pretty much the only one that I can get pretty much anywhere I go. So I go ahead and deal with that. All right, last question from Michael Christensen. Glad to see you back. I found the show after you stopped recording. I'm a big fan. Well, thank you very much, Michael, not only for finding us, but also for sticking around during the break. And you asked the question, if money were no object, what one set from the past would you collect? You know, much like Doug's question, very intriguing in that there's so many options, and that's what makes it so tough. And, you know, the easy answer is, oh, well, 52 Topps, you've got the Mantle Rookie, or 55 Topps, you've got the, you know, the paintings, you know, the standardized card size, you've got that legendary Jackie Robinson, he's stealing home plate, Roberto Clemente rookie card. And I thought, no, you know, what about 74? Because that was the first year that they eliminated all the series, released all the set and, you know, all the cards in one set. And you had the Washington National League goof ups. No. And I really thought about it. I said, you know, if there's one set that I would, if money were no object, if I was able to obtain this set, and I would have to do it in bits and pieces because I don't know too many people who have a complete set ready to sell. But if you were to write that check for me to purchase that, I would have to go with 65 Topps. And there's a number of reasons why I'm a big fan of 65 Topps. We covered it in episode 78, featuring the great Tony Oliva, who again got shafted by the Hall of Fame vote, the Veterans Committee. Although I am glad to see Jack Morris and Alan Trammell getting in. But, you know, the 65 Topps set, I love the design. I love the waving pennant. I love some of the, even though they're pose shots, you know, there's some great photography. And I just love the backs of the cards. There's something really cool about the dark blue background, the, you know, Topps cartoons from the era, you know, the style of artwork that was on there. So, yeah, 65 Topps would have to be it. And, of course, there's some really good cards in there. You've got Steve Carlton, Phil Niekro, Roberto Clemente, another one. A lot of the great star players from the 50s and 60s. You've got Mantle. You've got Mays. You've got the whole group of them. Anybody who was a star in the 60s, you know, Pete Rose, they're all in there. And, you know, I like the design. I like the selection of stars and rookies. I like the fronts. I like the backs. I like to, if I can ever, even if they're just beaten to a pulp, I like to buy lots of them and just look at them. I think they're just very nice sets. So that may surprise some people. That may be boring to some people. But, hey, Michael asked me, what would I do? 65 tops would be the set because, you know, another reason why is it would be very hard to actually, with money being a factor, actually tracking down all the cards from that set. So great questions again. And if you have any questions you want to ask for future episodes, just to send them our way to Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. It's open 24/7. Post your questions, post your comments, and we will answer them in the next episode, whenever the hell that happens. All right, so for this episode, our focus is on this 81 Tops grocery pack. And as I said, there is a YouTube link on the original Twitter posting. So if you haven't clicked on it yet, you can do so now. You can listen to me opening that pack, but I will warn you because I'm just going to pull the audio off of the video feed. I'm using a different camera. It's a different microphone. May not sound as good as the rest of this podcast. I'm going to work on that. We're going to try to improve that. But I'm going to go ripping through this 81 Tops grocery pack. It's got 36 cards. I'm assuming they're still in good shape because, like I said, I've had it sitting in a closet for a few years now. We'll see what's in there, and then we will go ahead and talk just very briefly about some of the players in this pack before we wrap it up. So let's go ahead and go over to the table here and to the video link. And we welcome you to the video portion of the program here. So I've got the 81 Tops grocery pack. Now, Tops did grocery packs back in the early 80s. They only did it for a couple of years. But what's a big difference between these and your traditional rack pack is that basically the little cells that held the cards, they were tightly wrapped, almost like mini cello packs, and then dropped into this little plastic sleeve. And then you had the Tops artwork on the front. And like I said, it was basically a rack pack, but with fewer cards. As you can see here in 1981, just 36 cards. Now, even though it has the name of a grocery pack, this wasn't necessarily carried in grocery stores in the sense of a supermarket. So this was more like what you would find in a Kmart or a Woolworths or a McCrory's, you know, kind of those department store, you know, not the big department stores like a JCPenney or Sears, but kind of those smaller, the old 5 and 10 stores. You could find these in some local grocery stores, but you were more apt to find them in the bigger stores, like I said, like a Kmart or, you know, even a Walmart, even though Walmart was still coming around in the early 80s. And in fact, if you look closely at the label there, there's the Kmart price tag, 67 cents or three for a dollar. Man, those are the days. All right, let's open this up here. Cut across the sleeve. Now, even though 81 Tops grocery packs, and to an extent they're cello packs, one good thing about them is the way that they were packaged. As you can see, let me just pick this one here. You know, very tightly wrapped. So the cards didn't go anywhere. Now, the downside to that is if the packaging got moved around a lot, and as you could see, you know, before I opened this, you know, the little packages were free to move around a little bit. Well, I mean, this is a you know, a grocery pack that's almost 40 years old. So these things have been moving around a lot. So yeah, they're nice and tightly packed, so they're not going anywhere, but these little packs, they're bumping into each other. And there may be a little wear and tear. Also, as you can see, the gum in, oh, yikes, in 37 years has bent the cards just a little bit, and I'm sure has just added a little more wax and gum stains to our favorite cards. Let's open up this cell first. As I mentioned before, we'll go through, we'll open the pack, take a look at the cards, and then I'll talk about some of the individual players and the cards themselves in just a little bit. Let's first just dump this gum. Oh, no. Oh no. Oh, yeah. You hear it? Poor Tug McGraw, who's been plastered with this bubble gum that's been tightly compressed all these years. Let's just get to Tugger first right now. So there you go, Tug McGraw. Coming off a World Series championship in 1980. So that's our first card.
We have Bob Welch of the Dodgers, very underrated pitcher from this time. But there were so many other really good pitchers, especially in the National League West back then. Kenny Reitz of the Cardinals. We've got Al Oliver of the Texas Rangers. I love those old Rangers unis. They would start changing out of those a couple years later. But Al Oliver, another very underrated outfielder, as you can see by his stats. Let me move him up a little closer to the camera here. Storied career, and he would play for several more seasons. And like I said, didn't quite get the credit that he was due. Victor Cruz, pitcher for the Cleveland Indians. Very happy to be here. We've got Jerry Turner of the Padres. I love the Taco Brown Padres uniform here. And also the detail to the hat. And we've mentioned this before about 81 Tops. They actually, you know, would add a little more detail, not just colors, but certain design elements to the hat in the lower left-hand corner. The batting practice jerseys, or the spring training jerseys of the Padres from this time, are just epic. Everybody looked like a melty cheese taco. Lee Lacy of the Pirates. And here's another detail element here. You know, the Pirates were wearing the pillbox hats back then. We've got Ed Glynn of the Mets. Andre Thornton, of the Indians. He's not Thornton. He is Andre Thornton, however. Hoskin Powell, who just doesn't look like he gives a damn when this picture was taken. And playing for the Twins back then, that is a high possibility. Jim Wolford of the San Francisco Giants. By the way, love the Giants script uniform from the late 70s, especially the black with the orange type. That is a style that has come back over the last few years with the Giants. And Jim Beatty of the Seattle Mariners, the original Trident hat and script there. All right, let's open up pack number two, or cell number two. Now, cell number one, the cards were not all that dinged up. So other than Tug McGraw getting a pile of 37-year-old bubblegum on him, they were actually in pretty good shape. All right, here we go. Let's separate the gum from the card. Oh, that hurts when I do that. All right. Pat Zachary, the honorary recipient of the slab of pink glue. So let's push that out of the way. So Pat Zachary, another pitcher with the lowly Mets at that time. Ed Ott. I always think that he and Mel Ott are often the easy subjects of crossword puzzle writers across America. Although they normally mention Mel Ott, but every time I hear Mel Ott, I think of Ed Ott, who was a catcher for the Pirates back then. Larry Bradford of the Braves. The Braves in 1980, that was the last year that they wore the lowercase A hat. One of my absolute favorites. We've got our all-star here, Rod Carew. Just a tremendous player, and I think, unfortunately, as time goes on, people kind of forget what he's done. He was one of the best players in the game, followed by Eddie Murray. You know, Murray was just an absolute beast at this point in time, as we pulled the card up a little closer. Just in his fourth season in 1980, averaging about, 28, 29 home runs. He would have over 400 in his career. And looking rather pouty on that card, which was apropos for Eddie Murray. Tim Foley of the Pirates. There's a great look at the yellow pillbox hat, but also one of the many goofy combinations of black and gold uniforms that they had. The Kansas City Royals with Jim Frey, I should say. The team card, I was never all that upset about team cards. Team cards I was okay with. It was the manager card I absolutely hated. But the Royals, of course, coming off their American League Championship season the year before. Darryl Thomas of the Dodgers. I love Darryl Thomas cards because he just looks like, I don't know, like he just came right out of the movie Car Wash. I mean, he just had that aura to him. Bill Stein of the Mariners. Again, the classic old typeface there, the powder blue road uniforms. Freddie Patek with the Angels near the end of his career, best known for his many, many years in Kansas City. Your earned run average leaders for 1980. Would you have guessed Rudy May was your ERA leader in the American League? Don Sutton for the National League, and Davey Goltz of the Dodgers. There's a nice little LA Dodgers commemorative patch on the shoulder there. I believe I'd have to double check that. I gotta look that up there Because that's not the 1980 World Series or All-Star Game one. That's a different one. I'll look that up when we're done opening up this final pack here. All right, pack number three, or cell number three. So we got Rod Carew, we got Eddie Murray. Not a bad keep. All right, here comes the gum. You ready? Oh! Yeah, good old Terry Forster of the Dodgers gets that honor there. All right, so Terry Foster, this card a little off-center, too. So you got the triple whammy here. You've got off-center, you got gum stains, and some rips, too, for being in the middle of the pack. Glenn Hubbard of the Atlanta Braves. We did a podcast on him, of his 86 Topps card. We'll tell more about him in just a little bit. Juan Beniquez of the Mariners. Now, this is interesting. The Mariners at that time, okay, so this is the original typeface here, the original Trident, but starting in 1980, they started utilizing the more modernized Trident with the star. Joey McLaughlin looks like he just got done baking in his Toyota Celica in the back parking lot. That explains the 79 Blue Jays real well. Charlie Moore, this is kind of what I looked like when I started losing my hair. Charlie Moore looks like he could be playing bass guitar for Bachman Turner Overdrive in this picture. Ron LaFleur, not too long after being released from prison and stealing a ton of bases, first with Detroit, but later with Montreal. Very underrated player from those great Expos teams in the early 80s. Cliff Johnson wearing the pajama pants Chicago Cubs road uniforms. This the vertical stripes, I think, might have helped Cliffy look a little more slender. Jeff Newman of the Oakland A's. The A's celebrating their 50th anniversary in Oakland, now wearing these green and gold combos more often. Our White Sox future stars, one of my favorites, Rusty Kuntz. It is Kuntz, kids. Trust me. Rusty Kuntz. Fran Mullins and Leo Sutherland. Oh, look at all these young faces hoping to be stars with the Chicago White Sox. Yeah, it didn't really happen. Don Robinson of the Pittsburgh Pirates, looking real unsure about the pitch that he just delivered. Mike Heath, a Brandon, Florida native, longtime catcher. He would be a backup catcher, starter for a few teams, but he was in the major leagues for a long time, played up until the early 90s. And then we'll light our fire with Jim Morrison, White Sox infielder. All right, let me get back to the good microphone here. Quite the haul there from this 81 Topps pack. And before I talk about the players, let me do a couple things. First of all, I've got to clean up this gum, which is just, I mean, I could tile my bathroom with this stuff. It's so hard. Listen to this. I mean, that's like going to a chiropractor and getting adjusted. That's terrible. Listen closely. This is 81 Topps gum on an empty stomach. I mean, you could like cut your digestive tract with that stuff. Now, all jokes aside, I've got to do one other thing here. Let me get the cards here. Hang on. Here we go. Okay, ready? Ah, that smell. You know that smell, the toxic smell, in a good way, of stale gum, cardboard, and wax. A smell we lost in this hobby after 1991. But nobody did it better than Topps, because they had the original gum. They had the brown cardboard stock for many of the years up until the 1992 set came around. Oh, I love that smell. You know, you can give me a box of 88 Topps, and there could be nothing but worthless cards in there, and I'll still stick my nose in it just to get that smell. But, you know, let's briefly look at the cards here before we wrap up this show. So, Tug McGraw, one of the unheralded players of the Miracle Mets teams, 69, 73, and of course the Phillies team that won the World Series in 1980. The father of country singer Tim McGraw, I believe the inspiration to Tim McGraw's big hit, Live Like You Were Dying, because Tug McGraw did die from a brain tumor in, I want to say, like 2003, 2004. And Tim McGraw finally made amends with Tug, you know, several years before
They were estranged. You know, Tugger was a bit of a partier, and Tim McGraw basically grew up without his father, his birth father, as much of a factor in his family. But, you know, like I said, Tug McGraw is just one of those guys that often gets overlooked from the Mets teams and the Phillies in 1980. Bob Welch, like I said, a very underrated pitcher. In fact, went 14-9 with the Dodgers in 1980, a member of the 1981 World Series champion team. Kenny Reitz, number 441 here in his second stint with the Cardinals. And Topps has a very interesting note here. And in fact, I'll share some of the notes here and the cartoons from the backs of the cards. Kenny collecting his 1,000th hit against the Cubs on August 13th, 1979. A lot of hits made against the Cubs back in 1979. Al Oliver, another unheralded player from the era, this time with the Texas Rangers, spent most of his career in Pittsburgh. And speaking of hit totals, had eclipsed the 2,000 hit mark in that previous season. Victor Cruz, it says here, it's kind of funny, in the back of his card, he lists horses as one of his hobbies. Doesn't say what he does with the horse, breeds them, races them, turns them into glue. I have no idea, Frau Blücher. Jerry Turner of the Padres. I absolutely love that Padres jersey, like I was pointing out. I love the detail, again, to the Topps hat. That's one of those neat things that you look for in the 81 Topps set. But if I were to have just a random batting practice slash spring training jersey, it would be that one. And my wife would hate it, which would make me like it even more. I've got one of those mid-80s Vancouver Canucks jerseys, not the one with the big V down the middle, but the, as we say in the hockey world, the Flying Spaghetti Skate logo. And I love it because it is so delightfully tacky. Lee Lacy, looking chill as possible with that Pittsburgh Pirates pillbox hat in the lower corner there. It mentions on the back here that Lee hit .382 as a pinch hitter in 1978 with five home runs. And that was with the Dodgers, by the way. Ed Glynn, you know, this is a guy that kind of gets lost in the history pages. He wasn't a very spectacular pitcher by any stretch of the imagination, but the 81 Topps card's got a couple of great cartoons on the back. Was born and raised in the immediate vicinity of Shea Stadium, so it makes it sound like, you know, he was born in the back of a Oldsmobile station wagon, but he's from Queens, and it also mentions he was a hot dog vendor at Shea Stadium before signing with the Tigers back in 1971. He was a free agent signee with Detroit and played with the Tigers for a few years there. So that's a pretty neat little note there. Andre Thornton, again, another one of those sluggers who kind of gets lost in all the shuffle of all the other better hitters or big-name hitters from the time. And there's a good reason why, because the 80s Indians were a terrible team. But he hit 28 home runs with the Indians in 77, 33 in 78, and 26 in 79. He missed the entire 1980 season with an injury. So this particular card, probably from the files where they Topps had a picture of him from like 1978 or 1979. Hoskin Powell, again of the Minnesota Twins, just looking like he just could not care on this particular day here. That's one of the best things about some of these cards is you got some guys that just look like, you know, they had to be dragged out of bed for these pitchers. Jim Wolford, the outfielder. Wolford, let me get his name spit out right. It is noted here on the back of his card, originally a shortstop. Jim has also played second and third during career, adds depth to Giants outfield. Translation, they don't really know what to do with him, and they don't want to put him through waivers. Jim Beatty of the Seattle Mariners. This is one of those guys who was fortunate that a team like the Mariners, an expansion team, came around, because he was originally drafted by the Yankees in 1975 and just wasn't good enough to stick with the Yankees. But the Mariners, by 1980, could use anybody, and poor Jim Beatty went 5-15 in that season. Speaking of pitchers who probably would have had success anywhere but New York, Pat Zachary and the Sad Sack Mets. Did you know, according to the back of this card, Pat Zachary was a co-winner of the National League's Rookie of the Year Award in 1976. He was with the Cincinnati Reds back then, the big red machine, went 14-7 in 38 games. Anybody know who the other co-rookie of the year for the National League in 1976 was? Anybody? Anybody? 3, 2, 1. Time is up. Your other winner of the National League Rookie of the Year in 1976 was Butch Metzger. Yes, Butch Metzger, a pitcher for the Padres in 1976, rather. He went 11-4 with a 2.92 earned run average. So there you go, your co-rookies of the year in 1976 for the National League, Butch Metzger of the Padres and Pat Zachary of the Cincinnati Reds. I'll take random baseball trivia for 800, Alex. Well, how about this? Ed Ott rode a bicycle to spring training prior to the 1979 season. Well, the Pirates training in Bradenton for a long time, so that's certainly doable, although Ed Ott rather nicely listed as a svelte 180 at 5'10", probably could use the exercise. Larry Bradford, again wearing that lowercase a Braves hat, one of my absolute favorites, actually was gifted one a few months ago by my good buddy Paul Kennedy of Fox Sports Sun. And I absolutely love it. And it's called the 1974 Braves design. But they wore that lowercase a cap from 1972 through 1980. That was the last year. And that was kind of when they were mixing jerseys. They went to the All-America team or America's team look. They actually did that when Ted Turner bought the Braves starting in 1977. They had that really ugly red pinstriped uniform. But then they went to the powder blue, the one that we're all familiar with from watching the Braves on TBS back in the day. But in 1980, the road jersey said Atlanta, but Atlanta was still in the lowercase a, but it was a big lowercase a, if that makes sense. In 1981, they switched to that script a, which they've had ever since then, of course, a different color palette, but it was a unique crossing of jerseys, if you will, in 1980, as modeled by Larry Bradford. Now, the Rod Carew All-Star card, this is card number 100 in the set. I said that Rod Carew was underrated, and I don't know if that's the right word, because he's a Hall of Famer, for crying out loud, and even at this point in his career was well on his way to 3,000 hits. But as I've mentioned in some of our other podcasts, he's one of those players who, as time has gone on, unfortunately has kind of fallen into the cracks just a little bit. And it's not because of his doing. It's, I think we've all gotten lost in the home run hitter as the years have gone by. And Rod Carew was not known for being a home run hitter. He did, you know, have some productive seasons hitting a few out of the park, but you know, very rarely had more than I think 14 was his career best, and he did that back in the 70s. I think the one thing that really drags Rod Carew down is he was not playing for big market teams and teams that won a World Series. You know, he was with the Minnesota Twins back, you know, they had some really good teams in his early years in the late 60s, but also he was part of that 1969 team that won the American League West flag, lost to Baltimore in the American League Championship Series, part of the California Angels teams in 1979 and 1982 that had 2-0 leads in the best of five championship series and then blew them to Baltimore and Milwaukee, respectively. You know, he had a great career, but he was always on those teams that were good but not great. And I just hope that really doesn't drag his standing down anymore. And we certainly wish Rod Carew the best of luck in his health. He's been dealing with a lot of health issues the last few years. Also, kind of falling through the cracks, Eddie Murray. And, you know, like I said, Eddie Murray was just an absolute beast. And he even looked like a beast. You know, he had that scowl, his rookie card, the 78 Topps rookie card. He's kind of got that, you know, I'm going to beat you over the head with this bat look in his eyes. He was also a little prickly when it came to dealing with the media. He was not a very warm individual, but a hell of a career. Later played for the Dodgers and the Mets and even the Indians. He was a very productive player with the Indians back in the mid-90s. And, you know, Eddie Murray, you know, I was thinking about this. If you go back in the history of the Baltimore Orioles, Eddie Murray was the third of tremendous slugging first baseman for the Orioles dating all the way back into the 1960s, the early 60s. You know, you go back to Jim Gentile. You then had Boog Powell for many years. And then, you know, when Boog Powell moved on, I think, to the Indians for the twilight of his career, Eddie Murray steps right in and just takes the world by storm. And an interesting note here on his Topps card as well. He was a high school teammate of Ozzie Smith and Daryl Jackson. So that's pretty nifty. Also, he won a game against the Chicago White Sox in 1979 with a steal of home in the 12th inning. Pretty ballsy of him, but that's Eddie Murray right there. That was a guy that you just did not mess with. Tim Foley, I don't want to call him utility infielder extraordinaire, but a guy who had a very lengthy career and servicing very well as a pinch hitter, as a utility guy, as a starter, as a guy off the bench, you name it. The Kansas City Royals team card, as I mentioned during the pack break, you know, I'm pretty cool with team cards. I like the older ones, you know, the ones that Topps tried to pull off in the early 2000s. I just was never a really big fan of those because it was kind of like Photoshopped. But you get a lot of great team pictures here, a lot of fashion statements being made in some of these older cards. But also, you know, the Royals were coming off of their American League championship the season before, so that was cool. Daryl Thomas, I just, like I said, he's always got that look on his face. It's like he's up to no good. Kind of from the Roland Office files, Daryl Thomas. It also mentions here, Daryl has played every position except pitcher, which once again translated means the Dodgers have no idea where to put him. Bill Stein of the Seattle Mariners here set a Mariner mark with three doubles on August 28th, 1978. Again, one of those players who benefited from the creation of the Seattle Mariners from, you know, basically the expansion draft. He was a member of the Mariners since day one, was a pretty decent player in the Cardinals system, started moving up the ladder a little bit with the White Sox, but was exposed and was able to have a pretty decent career with Seattle for a few years afterwards. Freddie Pawtuck, the longtime member of the Kansas City Royals, picked up from the Pirates after the 1970 season, but experienced the wonderful world of free agency in the winter of 1979 at the age of 35, signing on with the Angels, as pictured here. Now, much like the co-rookie of the year question from 1976, again, your earned run average leaders for 1980, you probably didn't have the combination of Don Sutton and Rudy May, but there you go. Here, how about this for a top five earned run average in the American League in 1980? You ready for this? I'm just reading off the back of the card here. Rudy May, Mike Norris of the A's, Britt Burns of the White Sox, Matt Keogh of the A's, and Larry Gura of the Royals. That's, I bet you didn't have that top five. In fact, just rounding out the top 10, Moose Haas of the Brewers, Steve Stone of the Orioles, Roger Erickson of the Twins, Rick Langford of the A's, and Jim Clancy of the Blue Jays. Yikes. A little more of a who's who on the National League side. Don Sutton followed by Steve Carlton, Jerry Royce, Vida Blue, Steve Rogers, Pat Zachary, Mario Soto, Eddie Whitson, Scott Sanderson, and Kenny Forsch of the Houston Astros. We got Dave Goltz, a pitcher for the Dodgers, as it mentions that he averaged 14 and a half wins his last 6 years with the Twins. And a very interesting point there, he was a 20-game winner in 1977 with the Twins. When you think of the 70s Twins pitchers, you're always thinking of Burt Blyleven, maybe Jim Catt. But yeah, Davey Goltz was one of the more unheralded Twins pitchers. Also a Dodger pitcher here, Terry Forster. It mentions he was the American League Fireman of the Year in 1974. 24 saves with the Chicago White Sox. Talk about cool uniforms, those red pinstripe White Sox unis from the Southside Hitmen from the era. Glenn Hubbard was the Braves' Rookie of Spring Training in 1978. I don't know if that's a compliment or an insult, but congratulations, Glenn. Juan Beniquez here with the Mariners. Again, another player who benefited from a team desperate to fill some roster spots. As it mentions, he was a member of the Red Sox, part of the playoff roster, also had a productive few seasons with the Rangers. Joey McLaughlin, who looks totally stoned off his gourd in this picture with the Toronto Blue Jays. It mentions that he made the Southern League All-Star team in 1976. Well, he was 12-8 with the Savannah Braves back in the day, bounced around the Braves system, then finally got a nice little jolt in his career playing in Toronto, where the marijuana laws are a little more relaxed than here in the United States. Charlie Moore of the Milwaukee Brewers, it mentions here that he turned down an Auburn football scholarship to play pro ball. Charlie Moore, the bald-headed guy here, or the progressively bald-headed guy here from Birmingham, Alabama, very smart guy. If he can turn down the Auburn scholarship, says the University of Alabama grad. Ron LaFleur, card number 710, very interesting couple of cartoon panels here, was the subject of a TV movie about his life. Doesn't get into more details, but just look up Ron LaFleur. You'll know how much of a miracle story he was to make his way to the big leagues. And it also says he and Rodney Scott set the mark for thefts by teammates in 1980. Not sure theft is the right word for Ron LaFleur. Stolen bases would have been a little kinder. Cliff Johnson, as I mentioned, wearing the pajama road uniforms. The Chicago Cubs had these awful road uniforms in the late 70s and early 80s. The powder blue with white pinstripes, and the fact that they were just a terrible team just added to it. Jeff Newman of the A's, it's got a nice little mention here. He had a 10-game winning RBIs, or he had 10-game winning RBIs for the A's in 1980, and those were some surprise A's teams as well. They were kind of rebuilding, but Billy Martin was able to whip them into shape and make them a contender. The White Sox future star card, I mean, Rusty Kuntz. Oh, what more needs to be said? It's Rusty Kuntz. And yes, it is Kuntz, by the way, kids. I know I've got somewhere in my big old monster box an 81 Tops Pete LeCocq, and I also know in the 81 Tops set there was a relief pitcher by the name of Don Ace. His name was spelled A-A-S-E, so I'm sure a lot of kids refer to him as Don Ass. So in the 81 Tops set, you had Kuntz, Ass, and LeCocq. I mean, what more does every teenage pimple-faced hormone-raging kid need while rummaging through his shoebox of collectibles? The Don Robinson card mentions he was a quarterback for his high school football team from Ashland, Kentucky, I believe. He was 6'4", 225 pounds. I always thought Don Robinson was a bit hefty, and those old gold Pirates uniforms added to it. Mike Heath, I mentioned, was from Brandon, Florida. I actually, funny how small this world is, the mother of a friend of mine who was in my Boy Scout troop like 30 years ago dated Mike Heath. They were both students at Brandon High School back in like 1979, 1980, around there, or actually earlier than that. Let's see, Mike Heath. Yeah, he would have been there in the early 70s. But anyways, yeah, she dated Mike Heath way back when, and here we are looking at his card right now, which is kind of creepy. And finally, Jim Morrison, as we light our fire, and he's wearing the throwback, so to speak, White Sox big collar jerseys of the day. He was a big star at Georgia Southern. Another guy who hailed from Florida, born in Pensacola and raised in Temple Terrace, which is a little city, not a suburb. They're their own incorporated city just outside of Tampa. So there you go, some nice little blurbs about all these random cards that we pulled together. In terms of money, I mean, yeah, you could probably get a dollar for the Carew card, a dollar for the Eddie Murray card. But, you know, there's so much more sentimental value to these, and it was just a lot of fun just ripping into a pack and just kind of looking at them. And they'll end up in the big old monster box with the other cards, but really fun to go through these cards once again. And we're going to have some fun doing it again. Like I said, I got this package of cello packs a lot from the late 80s, early 90s. Picked up a few junk wax packs at one of the local card stores earlier today. So what do you say we do this again? Like I said, I'm not going to promise that we're going to be able to keep things going for a long time because, you know, hockey season comes back around in September and October, and I'll get busy. And, you know, Little League fall ball starts up in September as well, so I'll be busy doing that. But, you know, I had fun. I hope you had fun. I know a lot of our hardcore listeners, they missed us. And, you know, I appreciate that. And I also appreciate those of you who came on after our last show, which was posted in early November, and who listened to the archives on Audio Boom. And by the way, you can listen to Wax Ecstatic via Audio Boom, Stitcher, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Blueberry, TuneIn. It's all out there. So if you have one of those as your favorite podcast platform, you can just search for Wax Ecstatic and find it there. And if you really like the show and would like to fund some of these junk wax packs that I'm buying and really encourage me to keep doing this, even on those weeks where I don't really feel like it, you can do so by making a cash donation of any amount. It could be $2, it could be $20, it could be $200. God bless your hearts if it's that high. Just go to paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, that's paypal.me/waxecstatic. I used to have a Venmo account. I put it up there because somebody asked about it, yet nobody made a donation to the Venmo account. So the Venmo account's gone. But again, if you want to make a cash donation as a thank you for doing the show, I do appreciate it because there are still some costs to maintaining the archive on Audio Boom. There's an annual fee to that. And there's also a time for recording and producing this and putting the show up there. So any donation is greatly appreciated. Well, let's try to do this once a week. Perhaps on Fridays, I'll have a show for you. I do know that I will have some old wax to open up here for you. And we'll do like we did today, where we just kind of go through some of these cards here from, you know, one of my favorite sets, 81 Tops, 1981, a great year for collecting. Fleer and Donruss come along with their clumsy products. But you had competition. The hobby really started mushrooming back then. And 81 Tops is my favorite of the three sets, not only because of its heritage status, but also great design. You got the little ball caps on there. The backs of the cards are easy to read. 726 cards set, plus the 100 traded cards, or 132 traded cards, I should say, that were kind of tacked on to the main set. So a lot of fun, you know, going through this, and we're going to go through some other stuff later. So join us, I don't know, next week. We'll try it out then, maybe next Friday. That would be July the 13th, if you're wondering. And we'll give it a crack once again. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Join us at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter at any time. Keep an eye out for the YouTube videos, which will correspond with our shows. And send us your questions, send us your comments, keep in touch. While I don't know how long this show goes, you know, we got a few weeks together, right? So let's enjoy it. We'll do it again next week. Thanks again for listening.